But for our audio podcast, we use Skype because the Skype backup recorder allows you to record every single microphone separately, which is a really a lifesaver when somebody delivers you their audio file and it's completely screwed up. So,
does it really? I should look into that. Okay, good to know. See, look at that. We haven't even gotten started yet, and the guy's improving upon my podcast.
What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Who got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Man being realistic.
As the story grows.
All aboard that's coming. Farewell to them that ain't. It's time for me to say the world is getting late. So I'll say farewell to Bristol and goodbye to Nailsy. And we'll let the rummy come aboard, cause he's good company. So why don't they take a risk and come along with me?
It may be Rumford and Ian, we all will marry me. Skipper, where are we going? A better place, says he. You're just going nowhere fast, so was we. The time will come inside a jar.
Welcome back to As the Story Grows. My name is Trav.
Are you seriously going to keep that?
I don't freaking care at this point. Dude, the day I've had, I'm so tired. I just want to get this over with, to be honest with you.
Got it.
So here we go. Welcome back.
Welcome back. I'm so tired, I'm delirious. Welcome back.
Welcome back to the As the Story Goes. My name is Steven, and with me is Trave.
I'm so tired, I spelled my name wrong. T-R-A-V-E. That's not my name. So my name is Trave, and we're going to talk about... Here's the outline of our intro. We're gonna talk... I have a really, really, really funny story. I think this one goes out to Jeff Becker about his story. We're going to talk about some iTunes. We're going to talk about Patreon. We're going to talk about stickers. We're going to talk about Steven's comp. And then we're going to talk about a band that John Petkow knows. There. Boom. Here we go. Ready? Everybody get on board.
We don't have to do an intro. You just said everything.
I'm done. Here comes Joey Sturgis. No. So here's the story. All right. So we recorded the Halloween episode. And you notice I didn't talk much on that one. With Betker and the regular Betker chapter all together. We were on the phone with Jeff for like 3 hours. And Steven went through and sliced and diced it and did what he had to do to it. That joint came out like 2 hours long, over 2 hours long. And it came out over a weekend. I had Seth W. in town. Didn't really get a chance to listen to it until like Sunday night a little bit. And then I finished it up on Monday. So Monday morning while I'm at work is when I got to the part of Betker's story where he tells us how Raft of Dead Monkeys got their name. And it winds up being a pirate skit from SNL.
Mm-hmm.
I'm laughing already. All right. So I didn't think anything about it. I just thought that's really funny that came from something so cheesy. And then Steven dropped the clip in there. I don't think I've ever heard it before. It sounds like John Goodman.
I haven't either.
Yeah. So funny. The Raft of Dead Monkeys thing settled into my brain, into my subconscious, and it just sat there waiting to strike because it knew in a half an hour it was going to get its opportunity to almost get me fired from my job. So I walk in. I'm an exterminator, so I have to go into commercial places and everything. I walked into a bank 15 minutes before the bank is open, so it was just women, like five ladies, and me. And this tattooed guy comes to the door, bang, bang, bang. And they open up the door and they unlock it. And I walk in and I don't know. It's like 8:45 in the morning. And I have to sign in and do my whole license thing on it. Because I'm in a bank. And here comes the subconscious thing. I just scanned as I walked through the front door. The woman had to walk all across the bank to unlock the door and let me in. And then the four tellers were like all the way on the other side of the bank. You've all been in banks. You know what I'm saying. Imagine someone had to come greet you at the door. The other tellers are all the way over there. Dude, one of the women were wearing an eye patch. And I lost my shit. I walked into a bank and completely lost control of it. And I'm laughing like I'm laughing now because I'm so embarrassed. And the woman who let me in was kind of looking at me like, oh. Should I let you in? Are you going to kill us all? And I was like, I'm really sorry, lady. I just got done listening to a really funny podcast. And
I feel so bad for this woman. She's already like self-conscious about it. She's sitting there signing checks, you know, with this damn thing on her eye. You come walking in. Clearly. Oh.
Oh, God. I did a good enough job that I think I only laughed loud enough that the woman who let me in knew that I was laughing, but I made it obvious that I was laughing to her. I was, like, hiding my face and covering my eyes because I started crying.
Dude, it's very odd timing, though.
I couldn't. It's not when's the last? Seriously.
With a pirate patch on.
Exactly. Maybe it's not funny to people that are listening, but seriously, when's the last time you went to a bank and one of the women were wearing an eye patch?
Right after a pirate story.
Freaking!
That's really funny.
Yeah.
Now you have to wonder though, what are the ramifications of your laughter today? What did that woman do when she went home?
I don't know. She probably the woman who let me in and out of the door probably turned around and she was like, "Oh my god, that guy totally saw your eye patch and he was laughing at you and everything." And yeah, I won't know.
She stormed out of there screaming after you left. She said, "I knew it."
Oh my god! When I go back,
I knew we shouldn't have come in.
When I go back in there next month, I'm horrified. I don't know what I'm more afraid of: that she's going to be there without an eye patch and I'm going to have to confront what happened, or she still has an eye patch on and I just. I'm going to lose it.
No, or even worse than that, she has an eye patch on still, but it's on the other eye.
Oh, my God. I'll quit. I'll call my boss and be like, it's obvious. I am not supposed to be in public around people anymore. Oh, my God. I have the most embarrassing story.
Oh, my word. Job. I love it.
So funny. So there's my Jeff Bedker Raft the Dead Monkey story. I wish this story would have came out earlier. Maybe I would have made the documentary movie, but whatever.
Yeah, actually – there's still time. No.
Maybe. You never know.
Yeah, that Jeff Bedker episode was a beast, but yeah, it was really fun having him on. Man, it was like listening back to it, there was like so many things I wanted to add to it or to respond to. It's weird when you're recording and when you're editing, you're not hearing everything that you hear when you just sit back and just listen.
Definitely.
Because you're so busy like making sure that it all goes right and you get everything you want to say or you want to listen, you know, the interviewee to say. And so like when it's done, then it's like all work and you have to like put it together. And so I'm listening back to it. Like I do with so many of our episodes and I'm like, man, I kind of wish I could relive this moment and I could have said that better or, you know, asked more questions, but yeah, it was a heavy episode, man. We had so much to talk about, but
you did a great job because I totally felt along for the ride for that one. I usually try to steer the ship on these things, but that one was like heavy theology, and I was like, Mars Hill, horror. I was like, where do I jump in? I don't know what to talk about with these guys. So whatever,
dead monkeys,
Raft of Dead Monkeys, nailed it.
Yeah, you know, it's so weird because it's like. You know, we're not a metal show. We're not a theology show. We're not a lot of things that we become.
or are we? Exactly. Are we?
Right. Yeah. And like, you know, we've gotten feedback from people who from the Christian camp who've said, you know, like, man, you guys should have went deeper or got a little more theologically sound on things. But honestly, I just like letting people talk. And, you know, clearly I don't see eye to eye with 100% of our guests. I mean, that's obvious. I mean, some of our guests have been pretty nuts.
You want to go deeper with people? You pay Simplecast $12 a month. Start your own podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Steven and I are morons. If we can do it, anybody can do it.
Speaking of Scott Renberg, he suggested, and I completely agreed with him, that we need to push our iTunes reviews. Because what people don't realize is iTunes is a really – big it plays a big part in our listenership. So
Mm-hmm.
And we are two people who care. Like, all we do, the only reason why we do this podcast is to be popular and to have tons of listenership. That's exactly why we do this. So, so I want everybody right now. I was being sarcastic, clearly, but yeah. Listen, we care about the growth. We're not gunpoint telling you guys to go do this, but if you guys want to help our show, there's a couple ways to do it. And one of the ways is to go to iTunes and leave us a review. Try to be nice about it.
So if you don't want to spend any money and help out that way, the best thing to do is go to iTunes for free and give us a review. If you
I'm smelling a money topic coming up.
I know, and it stinks. I feel this feels dirty, but
it does.
If you do feel like loosening your purse strings a bit, we do have a Patreon account. And thank you to our two Patreons so far, Jeremiah and Jonathan. I'm going to keep thanking you until we get more guys, more people.
Actually, yeah, honestly, it's astonishing to me that people would donate to something like this, but it does really help, and I really appreciate it. Anyone who goes that extra mile and does that. So thank you very much.
Yeah, man.
Podcasts are free. There's a million of them out there, but it does cost money to –
You can buy a cheeseburger anywhere, but people come to As the Story Grows for the flair, the personality, and the handsome. I fell off track. Handsome co-host. So we have the Patreon available. And another thing that we can do, drum roll, please. Steven, drop a drum roll in there.
That's my National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
Joy to the world. We have stickers.
That's amazing.
We have stickers now. So you can go to our Bandcamp. Link will be down below while you're listening to this. Pick up a free Megadeth cover while you're there if you haven't yet. And that we're going to use that as our merch page for now. So you can go there and pick up some stickers. They're going to be stupid cheap. Mm-hmm. Enjoy them. When you all buy your stickers, pull them out and take a selfie with them and send them to our Twitter or our Facebook pages, which are also found in the notes. And we'll repost them and make funny comments. So,
wow. You just sold me. All right.
What do you got? So, your turn.
I one other thing I want to talk about is the – anyone who's listened to episode 3 of our show when I talked to Timothy. we talked about a compilation CD we were putting out, and it's been a long, crazy process. But the bottom line is, when I got the songs turned in to me, I felt like we needed to beef up the compilation. So, I decided I'm going to put one last word out. Last call up till December 1st. I'm asking any band out there that's heavy, weird, noisy, whatever. It doesn't have to be strictly metal or metalcore or anything like that. It could just be heavy or any kind. Send me your song, high quality wave format, and
original song.
An original song. Yes, it doesn't have to be previously unreleased, although that would be amazing if this is a exclusive track. Send me a song if you want to be on this compilation. The compilation's a benefit CD for my friend Timothy, who was the drummer for Warlord. Warlord literally recorded a new song for it, which is amazing. And there's actually a B-side from the classic era of Warlord that's going to be on it. Living Sacrifice is going to be on this. They're actually giving us a song from the Hammering Process era, so that's kind of a big deal.
That's awesome.
A lot of bands, Matt Johnson from Roadside Monument, him and Clark Brothers, and the bassist from Frotus, they have a band called Deathbed Atheist. That's going to be on it.
Shut up! You got a Deathbed song?
Yeah. So
I might actually buy this comp.
God forbid. So I don't have the list here in front of me, but there's a lot of really cool stuff. But Maranatha is going to be on it. So yeah, I'd like to maybe get 5 or 10 submissions so we can get this comp kind of up to par. It's like some of the tracks we got, just not feeling them. No offense. So yeah, if you guys could send me a track at unteachers@gmail.com, I will talk to you about all the details and stuff like that. Send me your Bandcamp and all that contact info, and I'll let you know how it goes.
We'll include that email address. Include the email address in that notes too.
As of now, Veritas Vinyl is going to be pressing the comp on a CD, not vinyl. And so yeah, December 1st is the deadline, and let me know.
Nice.
I'd greatly appreciate it.
Speaking of the comp, one of our Patreon helpers, I don't know what to call him, Jonathan Petcow, has his own podcast called Respectably Loud. I totally dig it. I don't know why. Talk about all over the place. He talks to a folk person, and then he talks to his brother, who's a metal guy and everything, whatever. Really fun. I like the conversations. They're very organic and cool. He's doing a great job. His most recent, well, as of this recording, his most recent episode was with his brother, Evan Petcow, who plays drums in a band called The Wolf and the Epitaph. And they are going to be on your comp. And the song that he sent me, which I'm going to play right after this before we get to Joey Sturgis, let's not forget who the hell I'm talking to today. Let the Waves Smash and the Lightning Crash. Instrumental, really interesting stuff. I really dig it. It kind of scratches my prog itch. You know, I have that weird rush.
It's kind of like a fungus or a jock itch.
It's lower. It's lower than that. It's more in the grundle area. Anyway, this song itches it. It scratches it well.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, he sent me the song, and that was one of the newer submissions that kind of I'm trying to beef the comp up with. When I got that song, I got really excited because I was like, man, I know there's bands out there that are doing really cool stuff, and this is one of those bands. Like, it just made me really excited. I'm really glad that they're going to be on the comp because they're freaking awesome.
Yeah. And,
talent. This very, very, yeah, no shortage of the progressive side for sure.
This isn't a posturing, wow, brutal, tough guy. No, this is people that can play their instruments. And they're doing a good job with it. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to mention that it was recorded in the guitarist Andy's home over the past 2 years. It's available on iTunes and Spotify, all that kind of stuff. I'll put all these links in the notes and everything. Let's listen to a little bit of Wolf and the Epitaph with the song Let the Waves Smash and the Lightning Crash. And then we are going to, and then I'm going to swing it on over to metalcore producing award-winning, super cool, espresso knowledgeable guy, Joey Sturgis. See y'all cool. later.
All right. Have fun editing that.
welcome back to As the Story Grows for the next chapter. My name is Trav, and I'm talking to award-winning metalcore producer Joey Sturgis. This is crazy. I can't believe I'm talking to you. How are you, man?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on here. You might see me sipping on this espresso.
That's all right.
I love espresso. I don't know if you're into that at all.
Good morning. Can I take your order?
Can I get a tall chai?
A large black coffee.
A what?
Large black coffee.
Do you mean a venti?
No, I mean a large.
He means a venti. Yeah, the biggest one you got.
A venti is large.
No, venti is 20.
Danny.
Yeah. Large is large. In fact, tall is large, and grande is Spanish for large. Venti's the only one that doesn't mean large. It's also the only one that's Italian. Congratulations, you're stupid in three languages.
I'm sipping on a French press right now. I'm
okay.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, I'm actually very fascinated by coffee, and I learned about the entire process of how it's created, and I do my own roasts from time to time as well.
Do tell. I already didn't know we were going to be talking about that. What do you mean?
Well, the interesting thing about coffee is that the flavor comes from two different things. One, the source, and two, the way it's prepared. And when I say prepared, I'm not talking about how you would make a cup of coffee. I'm talking about how you get it from a cherry, which is actually what it is. Mm-hmm. It's actually a cherry, getting that to your cup. So, you know, they've got to open those cherries, then get the beans out. Then the beans are wet, so they have to dry those. There's all these different ways of drying the beans. You know, sometimes they put them in some countries, they put them on the road. And you've got these dirty beans, and that's part of the whole thing. And then in some countries, they do it in a facility. In other ones, they do it in a greenhouse. And there's all these, some of them are, you know, they'll wash the cherries, other countries won't. And that's what actually attributes to the final flavor that you get in the cup is how they treat the beans. So there's actually a cool website called Sweet Maria's that you should check out, where you can source beans from all over the world, because they do it. They basically do it for you, and then you just pick which ones you want, and they'll show you which ones are in season, which ones aren't. But I don't want to talk. I don't want to spend all day talking about coffee.
I don't mind because I'm, dude, I'm 40 years old, and you're the first person that I've ever heard that said that it's a cherry. It's always just been it's a bean. It's a drink from bean.
Yeah, it starts out as a cherry. Yeah, and they go to They don't have these massive machines that can like drive through the mountains and just go, you know, and get all this coffee.
Right.
So
right.
People have to wake up really early in the morning and climb the mountains and pick the cherries off the trees by hand and put it in a basket. And they have to carry the baskets up and down the mountains. And like, I don't think people appreciate what goes into
it's labor intensive. Sure.
Yeah. It's a very intense process. It takes months to get beans that you can actually roast.
Hmm. How about that? So what do you prefer then? If you've done the research, fast forward through the research for us and let us all take shortcuts. What have you discovered is like the best or your favorite or like what's the best path from growing on a cherry tree to the cup you're holding? I'm watching you hold right now.
Well, I'll just say that I really like the taste of Yemen coffee. And I'm not 100% particular on what the process is there, but I know that whatever the process is, it produces irregular beans. So if you were to just grab a 10-pound bag of beans from Yemen, you would see every shape, size, color of bean. It's just
okay. They
don't have consistency there. But that is what makes it interesting as a flavor. And when you take all those different beans and you roast them together, some of the beans become really dark roasted, some are light roasted, and that's because it's an inconsistent batch. And when you finally ground that up into into a coffee cup,
mm-hmm.
you just get a very nice neutral sort of you get a nice balanced flavor because you've got those dark beans in there, you've got those light beans.
Okay,
it's really nice. So Yemen is known for having inconsistent batches, and that's the reason why it has an interesting flavor. So I like that.
Oh,
Wow.
You are an analytical guy, aren't you?
Well, I get bored. I don't sit and watch TV. You know, that's boring to me. So
yeah, right on.
I spend a lot of time. If I'm interested in something, I'll learn everything I can possibly learn about it. And right now I'm interested in business. So I'm learning everything about how to do your own startups, how to go for investors. And I'm building several different companies, as you've probably seen, if you've done any research.
So, yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, so I'm very interested in that. And my mission in life is to help people create great music. So I always incorporate whatever my interests are into that. So learning about business, I've figured out how to create companies that help people make great music. And I've also started to become a little bit of an educator, and I'm working on that side of my skill set right now. I've done 2 Creative Lives. If you haven't heard of Creative Live, you should check it out. It's a really great resource for audio education. And actually, you can learn about anything there, really. You can learn about Photoshop. You can learn about arts and crafts. But they have a really cool audio program. That me and my friends are on there, and we share with you what we've learned over the years doing this professionally. And it's a great platform for that. And then also, I'm doing I've got my own podcast, JSFpodcast.com, where we talk to people like me and people that are cooler than me, and to tell you how they came up and how they've learned to do what they do. So,
And skimming, doing a little bit of research up with the podcast, and I haven't listened to any of it because I just came off a Halloween weekend. I barely had time to prep, to be honest with you. But I did look into it a little bit. It looks like you record 5 a month, and it almost looks like you have like a tier program depending on what people are willing to, just like anything, what they're willing to pay and put into it is what they get out of it. You have like live... you have group therapy, so to speak. So it's like they can kind of come together and be like, okay, here's what I'm doing. What am I doing wrong? As opposed to just listening to your podcast and writing down notes furiously and being like, okay, let me go try that. Okay, I screwed that whole thing up. Let me go listen again. You guys actually get on and can talk to people and walk them through it and everything. It's like an interactive podcast, which I don't think I've ever heard of anybody doing that before.
Yeah. Well, we have a bunch of different facets to what we're doing with it. So we call it a podcast right now, and that's actually going to change soon, but I can't talk about that. But let me just say,
whoa.
Called a podcast, but it's so much more than that, because you are going to, not only interact with us, you're going to interact with the other people listening to the podcast, which are like-minded people. They're on the same sort of wavelength of thinking as you. So it's a club. It's kind of like an exclusive club. Once you're in, you get to talk to Dan Corneff. You get to talk to Andrew Wade, Stephen Slate, Graham Cochran, Bob Katz, like all these people we've brought into our world, and you kind of get the ability to interact with them on our, we have a private club on Facebook where you, as soon as you're in the right tier, you get invited in and get to ask questions and interact. And then on top of that, we do these boot camps where we travel from city to city and me and a couple guys get into a studio and we sell you, if you're a subscriber of the podcast, you actually get the tickets cheaper. But you pay for a ticket, which is like your little slot in this studio, and we'll do about maybe a dozen to 15 people at a time. And we just bring them into the studio for 3 or 4 days of just hyper intensive education.
No kidding.
Yeah. Like 12-hour days. Like we're going to show you exactly how to mix a song. I'm going to open the song. Never heard it in my life. Load the files into the DAW, start mixing. 4 hours later, you'll see exactly what it would sound like if I had mixed it. You get to watch me do the whole process. Same thing with drum miking. You'll go into the live room. We'll start setting up the drums. We'll put the drum heads on there. We'll tune them up, make them sound nice. Put a microphone in front of it. Go in the control room, like get a sound. That's what the boot camps are. Then we do a mentoring program. So if you're at the highest level, we personally mentor you. We'll talk to you on Skype. We will email you. We'll talk to you on the phone. basically guide you through your career path and becoming a producer, an engineer, whatever it is that you're trying to do in the music industry.
Right.
We will mentor you to do that. And there's a couple of other things that we're working on right now that are about to become a part of this whole package that we're doing. So it's only going to get crazier and crazier, just more and more interactivity, more and more features, more and more products and services.
And I like the sense, I don't mean to get all hippy dippy on it or anything, but I like the sense of community rather than like it's isolated and Joey has this magic formula that makes everything sound amazing. And I'm going to like, yeah, it's mine. So now I can charge everybody as much as I can charge people. It sounds like you're going the opposite direction of like, yo, man, my bills are paid. I got Espresso. Everything's fine. Check this out. Why don't you try this? Do this, do that, which I really dig because I just wish I get the impression that there's everybody's willing to lend a helping hand. I think if you walk up to a guy after a show and say, I really like the sound, what are you playing? Oh yeah, dude, come check out my stuff. You know what I mean? It doesn't really seem like anybody's really hiding information or anything. Yeah.
Well, let me tell you, the reason why one of our shows is called Keys to the Castle is there's this ongoing joke where, you know, sort of some producers look at us and say, well, you're giving away the keys to the castle. Why would you do that? You're creating more competition for yourself.
Yeah, good point.
The thing that I've discovered that's just not true, and the reason why is because if you know everything there is that you need to know about this, you're still not going to be good at it. You have to put in the hours, you have to put in the work and the time to get the experience to even utilize this information. You know everything you want about a compressor, but load up a vocal track and slap a compressor on there. Now what are you going to do?
Right.
You know how the compressor works. Doesn't matter. You got to make that vocal sound good. So the reason why we have a community around what we're doing is because it is the only way that you can progress and get good at this. That's how I got good at this, because I was on a community called Ultimate Metal Forum, where there was all these people who are willing to, you know, they weren't professionals and I wasn't a professional either. So we were both sort of in the same boat, but sure. there were some people who were like, oh, well, I figured out how to reamp guitars better than everyone else, so I'm going to start talking about that. Oh, I figured out the best way to mic a snare drum. I'm going to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
You get all these different people talking about these different things, and you get this really cool community of everyone sort of learning from a self-contributed pool of knowledge. And we've discovered that seems to be the most effective way of taking a group of people and empowering them to do what it is that they want to do.
Right.
And you can't do it through a product. You can't do it through a get rich quick scheme or,
sure,
you know, give me $100 and I'll tell you my secrets. That doesn't work,
right,
because that becomes limited. Whatever is put into that package, whatever has been placed into that little cup, you drink it once and that's all you get. So we figured, let's make a kitchen instead of a cup. You know, mm-hmm, come to our kitchen and eat every week. We're going to have served different food. We're always going to change up the ingredients and mess around with the cooking techniques and see, you're going to get a lot out of that. So that was our approach to the whole thing. And it really, it's a super, super downplay to call it a podcast, but we'll be changing that soon.
That's the medium that you're choosing to get it out there as of right now. But
yeah,
it sounds like it's you already have too much that you want to do to squeeze it into what's called a podcast. You
know? Exactly. Yeah. It's
right, just that makes sense.
So much more.
And I like everything you just said, because honestly, when's the last time that you taught somebody as much as you know and then lost a production gig to them?
Like, yeah, I mean, believe me, it has happened.
But
it's not necessarily the most, you know, you think about things that are a threat, right, to you and your career. It's not a threat at all, because, in fact, I would almost call it flattery, just because that person wouldn't be there if it wasn't for me. And there's a couple of those that I've had. I've had proteges throughout my career. You have Nick Sampson, for example, where, you know, he started out just being a guitar player in a band, and mm-hmm, he was interested in recording, and I was interested in having someone that was super loose that I could mold. into kind of whatever I needed. So I was like, hey, man, do you want to try screwing around with editing these drums or editing these vocals and stuff? And I would show him the techniques that I used to do that. And he caught on really quickly. You know, it was intuitive to him. And that allowed us to form a cool working relationship, which we did for a couple of years. And then he started to get his own life. You know, he had a dog, a girlfriend. He needed a house. So he got a house. Okay, now I got to pay for my house. I can't do that just on editing money. So I need to record some bands in my spare time. Hey, I really like recording bands. And it just, over time, it turns into like, hey, like, I've got these three records booked, and so I can't edit guitars for you right now. And, of course, that'll avalanche into, you know, getting his own projects. Now, speaking to what you said earlier, losing a project to someone that I've taught, that has happened, like, maybe once or twice.
Really?
But it's only because, I'm fairly sure, like, my memory is a little hazy, but I'm fairly sure it was offered to me, and I said no, which, you know, I turned it down simply because I'm just a busy guy, and I try to put my time into things that I know will grow. Mm-hmm. And if I know that a situation I'm getting into with a certain band's not going to grow, and maybe I'm not even the right fit for what they're trying to accomplish creatively, mm-hmm. I'll back out. Like, I'm not there for the money. I mean, obviously I need to make money, but I'm not there to be like, hey, like, hire me, only me. Like, some people need to do a radio rock record, and some people need to do a super metal record. And depending on what the band is and how I'm feeling, like, that might not be it might or might not be the right fit for me. Gotcha. So I have to think of it like that. On top of my current responsibilities that I have to all these people, you know, with the podcast and, Joey Sturgis Tones, these are things that are actually changing people's lives. And if I was to just abandon them out of nowhere, it would be a huge hit to a lot of people. So mm-hmm. can't, you know, I've got to be careful with my time.
Gotcha. All right. So that's interesting. For those of us that aren't really, I mean, I'm a hobbyist and a fan more than I am. I can't really speak the language. I just started doing a podcast, and here I am talking to somebody that can. So to ask a question like that, when somebody says, it's not really my style of project, I'm glad to hear that it isn't just paycheck. I'm sure if somebody just comes in and bowls you over, then you have to do what you got to do. But it doesn't sound to me like you're necessarily only metalcore and not rock. It sounds like you'll do the right rock record, the right metalcore record, and you actually kind of like how do you take that temperature? How do you gauge that? Is it just
I just go off of my gut. Okay. One thing that I think I've been blessed with is an amazing gut instinct, because it allows me to know within seconds of what I should be doing. I don't know why I have that or where it came from, but maybe it's just from my upbringing or something. But like,
technically Joey Sturgis mixing an album, or like life stuff?
Everything. I feel like I've had a good gut instinct approach to anything. Even if I don't really know, like, I've been able to gauge, like, someone say someone contacts me and says like, hey, would you do this interview? I know to say yes or no immediately. And I don't know why. It's just like, I know. It's really weird. And
well, that's flattering. Like, thank you.
just like with this opportunity, someone said, hey, would you want to do As the Story Grows? And it came from my PR guy. And I was looking at As the Story Grows online, and I was like, okay, this makes sense. Like, this is a good place. And I trust Ryan. And I know, you know, Ryan knows what he's doing. And so this is a good opportunity for me to, give not only education and knowledge to other people, but sort of spread my influence, I guess, right on the internet. So
I think, it's a small crowd, but I think this is the right crowd, because I think, as you know, obviously you're a music fan. Half of that crowd standing there jumping up and down and screaming and having fun, half of them go home and play instruments, at least.
Yeah. They're all enthusiasts. Now, like, that's the biggest thing that we see happening, is that every band has at least one producer, quote unquote. You know, someone that's in the band who has a laptop and is so interested in recording and just does it, you know, and makes the band's demos and does all the band's backing tracks and stuff. So the more and more I see that happening, I feel like we need to embrace it, because that's just the direction that the industry is going. And I don't really, I don't see record sales getting better. You know, they're just going to get worse. And that's bad news for producers. But let me just say this, because there's a lot of people that want to get into doing what I do. And of course, you hear us going from place to place talking about, well, you know, record sales are declining, blah, 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 blah. That doesn't mean you should run away, because let me just say, you can go from whatever you're making now to 5 or 6 figures in a single year. You can make that transition in 1 year. And the reason why I know that is because it's happening. People that are on our little society, our little club that we have, those people, for example, one of our listeners just started working with Sony. And definitely wasn't working with any labels before he had started listening to the podcast. So that's big. And we know what it takes. We know what kind of decisions you need to make and what kind of choices you need to make in order to step up your game and make that income. Now, if you can't survive on 5 or 6 figures a year, I don't know. How are you living?
you're living too large anyway.
Right? Yeah. So I definitely think that while the industry does kind of need to change the way it's focused on how it generates money, that's a much bigger problem than I have a skill set that I'm interested in and I can help creative people. I think here's the thing. 10 years ago, there was only one type of band. And that was a band, like a person that makes music and then tours. Now there's like 10 types of bands. You've got super groups that are like, they live on YouTube and they make like their own music and they make their own videos and they have millions of subscribers. Then you've got people like, I don't know.
Can you give, as you go through this, I'm super interested. Can you give a couple examples of each one?
Okay. So for the first one, let's just say a super group on YouTube or something, right? Let's say Boy in a Band, or that's a YouTube channel, or Terabrite. You know, Terabrite, for example, has like 200,000 subscribers, and they do covers of pop songs, but they do it with metal. Well, it's not metal, but you know, heavy guitars, heavy drums, right. and light singing. Take Boy in a Band. He is this British guy with long hair, and everyone says, "Oh, you've got this long red hair, and you look like a sissy or something." And he's like, "I'm not. I'm really smart, and I can rap, but I can also scream, and I can also sing, and I can also make dubstep, and I can also like." He does all these things. Okay. And right now, he's doing some very interesting things. He's actually changing the school system with his videos, which is freaking crazy.
What? What does that mean?
You gotta check it out, Boy in a Band. He made a video. He's upset about the school system. He made a rap about it, and the video went viral. And now the school system is changing its stuff. They're making changes in the school.
Wow, totally worth Googling. I'll be on that as soon as we're hung out.
Amazing how empowered we can. You know, here's what I look at it like. Okay. If I make a plugin, right, Joey Sturgis Tones makes a plugin, and that gets into the hands of the right person, and it allows them to create this song better than they ever could have created it before. And that song gets on YouTube, and it reaches a bunch of people and touches them in a certain way. That's so powerful. Like, that's so much more powerful than helping a band make a song so that they could tour longer. Like, that's why I'm looking at this. It's like, I would rather build the next Joey Sturgis and also build the next like Boy in a Band on YouTube.
Nice.
Then I would like have the next Devil Wears Prada. No offense to any of those guys. They're great. And I love
them. No, I know what you mean. I know what you mean.
But it's just such a bigger idea.
That's biblical, son. Instead of giving a man a fish, you teach him to fish.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's where my head's at right now. And that's why I think it's a much bigger mission and goal to attack, and it's more challenging, and that's what makes it more interesting for me. Whereas, like, you know, just making a chorus more catchy, that's not a very like right. That's not the most noble cause of things to be doing. I kind of forget the original question, but I think I maybe answered
it. This podcast doesn't have original questions. We're just like we just keep plowing, we'll figure something out. We were talking about how there used to be a band Like, I think everybody kind of has a like I do. I mean, I'm of all the instruments out there, I'm a drummer. So I always wanted to get myself into a Larry Mullen Jr. situation where it was like I get to hang out with the same other three guys and we make music the rest of our lives. That would be awesome, you know.
So here's the thing with what you just said, Luke Holland. Let me actually type in his channel real quick because I want to see how many subscribers he has.
Right. I know who you mean. He's the guy that does all the amazing drumming videos.
Yeah, so there's another situation where you're not necessarily producing bands and you're not necessarily producing music. You've got a drummer who he knows how to play drums and he knows how to create beats, but he doesn't know how to make videos and he doesn't know how to do makeup and he doesn't know how to mix drums and he doesn't know how to produce content. Mm-hmm. So there's another avenue for you to plug yourself into,
right.
And you could be editing his drums or, you know, mixing his drum sound. So he's got 292,000 subscribers on YouTube.
That's bananas.
And total views is 44 million.
Is that all?
44 million views on YouTube. So this is a completely new, this is a thing that I've gone around and talked to a bunch of different places and this being one of them. I've been saying like, hey, you should be thinking about outside the box. So keep your mind open on all these other opportunities there are for you to be working on these other projects, with YouTube being one of the main sources of all of it, really.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Unbelievable. I didn't know you had that many subscribers.
That's a built-in audience. It's more than
– yeah.
Okay, so one of the records I did this year, I'm not going to say which one. But I'm going to pick a record that I did this year.
Okay.
First week sales were 7,000 copies.
Okay.
So compare that to how many views they have on their music video. And it's like almost 1 million views. So how do you go from millions of viewers, a captive audience, people that are actually watching your video, to only selling 7,000 products? I really believe that there has to be a whole new way of thinking about how we consume the music industry. And I think YouTube has a really good platform for us right now where we can share creative media. It doesn't necessarily have to be a movie. It doesn't have to be a music video. There's all different types of visual media that you can combine with audio. Mm-hmm. On YouTube, and I think we should just embrace that. It was like, look at the biggest mistake that the music industry ever made was to try and fight MP3s, right? When MP3s came into existence, music industry was completely resistant and raised the price of CDs and tried to do all these stupid things that just didn't work. And look what ended up happening anyway. Now I think the next thing you're going to see, obviously, streaming is going to take over. And I really honestly believe, this is my own thought, but I really honestly believe that Apple will take over all record labels at some point. I just think that's in their path. So if that's true, and if we're living in a world where that can happen in the next 5 years, then we need to start thinking about different ways of doing this. And I think the things that people who coming up and want to be me, they're always like, oh, I can't wait till I do record label projects. Get that mindset out of your head and go on YouTube and start doing it now. Like, you could easily hit up these people and say, hey man, I've done some drum editing and I really like drum editing, or I've done some drum mixing, I really love drum mixing. Here's some examples of my work. I'd love to work with you. And boom, you're going to be instantly put on a platform of 44 million views and 292,000 subscribers. Like, that's bigger. Right. Bigger and better than doing a record that sells 7,000 copies.
In an industry that already looks like it's going downhill.
Yeah. So
you have to diversify. I talk about this with my guests all the time. Is it seems like the most successful musicians I know or speak to are not only musicians. They can't be only musicians. I think it might have been Iggy Pop that said, if I had to survive on just Iggy Pop songs, I'd be tending bar in between sets. You know? And like,
it's all about brands.
Yeah, it is. Just spoke to Sasha from Intronaut. The guy has his own custom guitar company. Loves grinding a piece of walnut into a guitar. Dude, yeah. Rock it. Embrace that. This guy has a graphic company. This guy started a merch company because everybody's always going to need shirts. This guy does his own, you know, does what you did. Like, I play guitar in a band and decided I really like twisting the knobs and making things sound good. So now while my band is on downtime, I do that for a bunch of other. Like, everybody does 15 different things. That's the only way you can stay afloat. If you just want to pigeonhole yourself into, I'm going to just sit here and wait until a Devil Wears Prada comes along, you'll be hungry.
Yeah,
you better exactly. be lucky too, you know.
And for me, I know it's different things click for different people in different ways. But for mm-hmm. me, I had a meeting with an investment advisor one time, and he told me, he's like, "Look, you can invest in Google if you want. You can invest in Tesla, whatever. Those are the type of things that are cool, and yeah, you get excited when you read news articles that say, oh, their stock increased 20% last month.
Right.
But he's like, that's not the right way of investing, because those things are still new ideas. He said, he was like, if we go to war tomorrow, everyone is going to wake up, take a shower, brush their teeth, drink a cup of coffee, and put on a shirt. And that was so powerful to me when he said that. It made me think about it. It was like, people are not going to stop making music ever, even if it sucks completely as a product and now it becomes free. Nobody can sell it anymore. People are still going to make music. So how can we stay employed in that sort of world? And I think it just empowering creators is the best way, because creators are always going to want to create. And they're always going to be looking for new ways to do it, faster ways, quicker ways to get their concepts to reality. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the strongest things that Joey Sturgis Tones offers, is that we build audio products and software that allow you to sort of break down the barrier of the technical and scientific side of creating music, and mm-hmm. allow you to get closer to your creativity by, you know, in being able to interact with your sound, your recording, in a much more intuitive way. And right. that's what been our approach to audio plugins. So
interesting. I also know from just past experience with having different positions in different companies, let's take music out of it for a second. You're talking about how people invest in different tiers with your, we're calling it a podcast, but with your online educational community, we'll call it whatever.
Yeah.
You'd rather have numerous people giving you little tiny bits of money as you go, and you have the relationship, you have the email address, you have correspondence, you have the community behind you, rather than nothing, giant spike where you do a job, get paid, nothing. Every sales rep wants a contract where I know how much I'm going to get per month for the next 3 years or something like that. So you can actually start to budget yourself rather than sit there and freaking, you know, doing your ramen noodle thing, starving, get paid, and then just go back and pay all the bills you ran up anyway. And then now you're broke again. It's not a good way to budget your life. People don't keep their houses when they live like that.
Right.
So when you're doing little tiny things all over the place, and you kind of know how this much is coming in, and look at Patreon. Look what Patreon is doing for people. Yeah. Now I know I can make this much per month. Oh, okay. Now I can actually afford things, rather than, boy, if I only had this much money, I could do that. Boom. And you get paid for something and you have the money. You're going to do it once and run around begging for money again. I that makes sense. Everything you're saying makes sense. Obviously you're talking to me from Joey Sturgis and Enterprises there with all your different
heard that.
that let's wind this back though. I love everything you're talking about, but how does this all get started? Where, I mean, what a weird, gross, podcasty kind of a question, but when did the bug bite you to say this is the direction I want to go? Everybody wants to be a rock star, right? You want to be a guitarist in a band and the chicks and the money and the, but it's, I think it takes a special person to go, wait a minute, I want to master a record. I don't know anybody like that on my personal level. I know people that like, I have to master it. I'm going to pay somebody, or I know a dude, or somebody, you know what I mean? Where does the producer's beginning lie? What started that?
Well, for me, it was never a goal. Mm-hmm. It became a goal, but it never started out as a goal.
Okay.
So for me, it started out as a natural progression of environment. So the environment I was in is that I was a drummer in a band. We needed to record. We didn't want to pay anyone else to do it.
What band? Anything?
No. No one would ever know this band.
Okay, skip it.
Yeah, that's fine. Right. I come from a small town, Connersville, Indiana, population 15,000. So anything that was happening there, the world doesn't know about it.
you were huge in Connersville, right?
Yeah. I actually ended up on the Connersville Wikipedia by the time I moved out, so that was fun. Now I live in Michigan, but that doesn't matter.
Gotcha.
So I was a drummer in a band, and we wanted to record. I knew of a friend in town who had he basically had a house and then a garage. The garage was detached, mm-hmm. but it was like an oversized garage. So he had gutted the inside and turned it into a whole, you know, the inside looked like it was a house. The outside looked like a garage. So he mm-hmm. bolted the door shut and like built a wall over that and all this stuff.
Got right. It.
And then he put a couple walls up and built a makeshift recording studio in there. And I had known him through my dad, because my dad was a guitar teacher and had taught him guitar lessons. He was a guitar player.
Okay.
And I had played I started playing drums when I was 9. So when I was 9 years old, I was in a band like of 20-year-olds. It was weird, but that was that was my childhood, was playing in like, you know, we'd go to like a festival, like say state carnival or something like that would be in the park.
Okay.
I would be on stage playing drums in a band of 20-year-olds. Like,
right on. Playing what? Like, obviously, metalcore.
Drums. Playing stuff like Green Day covers and like, you know, Nirvana and Metallica. And all
gotcha.
That. So radio music, I guess. Mm-hmm. So long story short, around the age of 18, I'm playing drums in this band. We're like, dude, we should make a demo. MySpace is big at the time. Let's put our demo in MySpace. See if we can get shows and I don't know, do what you do when you're a band.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I was like, all right, I'm going to ask my friend if he'll let me hang out in his space when he's not there, because he works really early. He wakes up at 7 a.m. and goes to work. So between the hours of like, you know, whenever he goes to sleep, like midnight to 7 or whatever it is, like he's not using this place. Can I come in there and mess around? And he gave me a key. I went in there and messed around for a good long time. Started out, I think, working on his stuff at first, and maybe some of his friends' bands. Whatever was going on in the area was like happening there. So I would go in late at night, open a song, and then like save my own version, so I'm not like messing with anyone else's stuff. Right. And then just like go in and, you know, get crazy. And long story, or well, not long story short, but after a while, I got to the point where I started to get a little comfortable with like, okay, you put the microphone here on the kick drum and then you do this with the EQ and it sounds like that.
Mm.
Still had no clue what I was doing, but it was enough to get started. So brought my band in there. We play a couple songs. I record them all. And then I mess with them for a while until I get something that's pretty cool. And then I actually put that on MySpace. And, the next thing that happened was sort of the whole snowball effect, which was people contacting us saying, hey, We heard your recording on MySpace. We want to know where you're recorded.
Where'd you get it done?
Yeah. And yeah, that was the answer, of course. And then they were like, whoa, would you record us? And so I asked my friend, and he's like, yeah, give me 10%. You can do it. So I did that for a while, a couple years, actually. And the relationships that I built during that time was everything, because those were the people that were kind of really constructing the next generation of music. And no one really knew that at the time. We were all just being kids and, you know, going crazy. But
sure.
But the songs that came out of that, like Attack Attack, for example, right?
Right.
They went on and sold like 250,000 records, and Devil Wears Prada's like still touring, like Mayhem and
yeah, rather and popular.
So like everything at that time was definitely a big movement, but nobody knew it. Mm-hmm. And I just happened to be the dude that was like nerdy enough to learn about computers and know how to do all this recording crap, but then like still in tune with the scene. Like I was a cool guy because I was in a band and I played drums and I wasn't like a nerd, you know? So,
right.
Those two things just like collided at the right time. And then I, of course I played a show with the Devil Wears Prada, and that's when that relationship sort of kicked off. After their set, I was floored by their set at that time. And after the set, I went up to him and said, hey man, I got this little kind of makeshift recording studio back in Connersville. Here's some stuff that I recorded, and tell me, you know, please let me know if you want to work together, because I would love to record you. And their answer was just like, oh, that's cool, but no thanks, we want to do it ourselves. And I was like, that sucks. So it took me like 3 months of emailing them over and over again to convince them to come and record with me. And we did the EP.
Stop right there.
Yeah.
Stop right there. Joey Sturgis had to chase somebody down for 3 months. So if anyone is sitting yeah. If at the time you weren't Joey Sturgis, you were exactly. Joey Sturgis. But you need to stop sitting around and crying that it hasn't fallen in your lap yet.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, please. I just hit play again. I pressed pause on you. Continue.
Yeah, it really did take the persistence and the motivation to – I wanted to record them so bad. Like I was like, this is exactly what I want to do. Like this is it. There's no other band on earth. This is the band. That was my mentality. I was like, if I don't record this band, then I'm probably just going to go get a normal job and stop. So if it wasn't for them saying yes, I probably wouldn't be here.
About that, that's interesting. Now, where are they from?
They're from Dayton, Ohio, which was about an hour from where I was located.
I was going to say that had something to do with it too.
The thing that yeah,
you didn't fall in love with a band from Brazil and kind of be in trouble then, right?
Connersville, Indiana, was a blessing in disguise. Huh. But I have a love hate relationship with the place, but it was an hour away from Indianapolis, which is the capital of Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was pretty much an hour away from Dayton and an hour away from Cincinnati. And also anyone from Kentucky was that what's a place in Kentucky? It's really close to Cincinnati. It's like separated by a bridge, that little area too. So all of those places were magnetically attracting to Connersville because I would take the one band from Dayton and do three or four songs. They go back, that goes on MySpace, and that webs out there. Mm-hmm. Then we do this band from Indianapolis, that webs out there, do this little thing from Cincinnati, and you get this whole tri-state thing going on, and that just starts to spread because MySpace was taking off, and so the internet thing was taking off. So I do the thing with Devil Wears Prada. They get signed due to that web thing happening. That web thing was the reason why I rise all the way over here in Portland, Oregon, taking notice of what's going on over here in the Midwest. They're like, hey, we want to sign the Devil Wears Prada. They get the deal. And Prada is like, well, where do we go do our album? Of course we go to Joey Sturgis because that's what we know. That's where we were. And that's how I got my first record. It wasn't like I had to, you know, impress anyone too much. I just had to be good at what I was doing and mm-hmm. persistent enough to chase down the right opportunity. And I understood that it was a good opportunity for me. So I really think that's as simple as it gets now. Easier said than done, obviously. You know, finding opportunities, especially nowadays, is a completely different scenario. MySpace is dead. Facebook is weird, and Twitter is declining as well, and Instagram is getting bigger. And so YouTube, I think, is an interesting platform that I think everyone should start pursuing more. Really, honestly, if you want to know the secrets of look at what everyone else is doing. I mean, how can you ignore it?
Right.
Songs are debuted on YouTube now. So,
yeah, they are.
So do that.
Lyric videos became like a thing. Like, yeah. There's people out there that, like, you're talking about find your thing. Some people's things are lyric videos. They're just putting words into, you know.
Yeah.
And it looks like that car commercial during the football game where all the words come across the screen and they come in all angular and stuff like that. And it's like for a Pennzoil commercial or something.
Yeah, and a lot of – I will say a lot of work goes into the guys that do that stuff. They are freaking amazing.
I can't fathom – yeah, but everybody wants to wait for that pre-formatted thing to come out, right? Okay, I'll just type my band's lyrics in and hit go, and the app, and the app costs me 99 cents. Dude, just do it yourself.
Yeah.
Cool. So, cool.
That's the landscape. That's the environment. And once you start to make those connections, you will see those light bulbs of opportunities going off. And I've seen it, and that's where I'm spending my time and energy. And I think anyone who wants to make music their living needs to have that same mindset.
Yeah, and do it in Connersville, Indiana.
Yeah.
Or do it in your Connersville, Indiana. Like, back in the day, before internet, it was the Seattle scene, the New York scene. Oh, they have like an L.A. thrash kind of a vibe to them. Those walls don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
There's this cat in a garage giving 10% to his buddy in Connersville, Indiana, that pulled Devil Wears Prada, which got the attention of Portland, Oregon. And we all know Portland, Oregon and Seattle and that whole scene, they're always cooler than us, right?
Yeah.
Well, here they came to you. You know, like, just do your shit right here where you have it, you know? Just let it grow from there and keep going. Keep swinging away at it.
Yeah, and I always say to find your voice and to approach things. I see so many people are like, well, how am I supposed to make a kick drum sound good? Well, I think
That's a great question. I still haven't figured it out.
that's good, though, because, see, the thing that we have in common is that I also feel that I still haven't figured out how to make a kick drum sound good. So I try to tell people, like, you, instead of going online and looking for how to build a building where you can literally, I could give you a pad of paper of all these, I give you 1,000 pages, and it would say, here's how you build a building.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would take that 1,000 pages, read each one, do each step. When you get to the end, you'll have a building. Okay. It doesn't work like that for this. And I think more and more people need to realize that don't be looking for the answer. Look for ways to find the answer on your own.
Right.
And the second thing is, don't discredit the sources of education, such as what you and I are doing, because mm-hmm. we're not we're trying to give you the opportunities to see your own way. We're trying to give you the information and the knowledge that can empower you to find out how to make kick drum sound cool in your own way, rather than saying, use this EQ and this compressor and then make sure the microphone is this far away and now you'll have a perfect kick sound. Because it's just not true. It doesn't work that way. It never will.
Right.
Because unless somebody changes the freaking design of the kick drum, come on, it's been how many years now? I complain about that all the time. But anyway.
It's a wooden tube.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
It's the most – guitar is the most poorly designed instrument ever, for example.
Okay.
The G string never sounds right, does it? Why hasn't anyone fixed that?
I have no idea.
But anyway, that's the thing. You have to know that there's no right answer and there's no wrong answer. It's just getting the right attention at the right time of people and doing it in your own unique way that makes it fresh and new and exciting to people who are tired of listening to this one. So
I always envisioned it. Like I said, I play drums. I don't know how to play guitar. Like I can play like one Nirvana riff on an acoustic maybe, and I still screw it up. But one thing I do know is that I can hand it over to you and you twist all the knobs and you preamp this and DI that or whatever. And you get that guitar to sound a certain way and you hand it to a guitarist and he goes on the guitar and doesn't touch anything. And hands that guitar to somebody else, and he plays the exact same notes. It sounds different, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Why? Why does it sound different? Because people are ruining their lives and wasting their time trying to get that guitar to sound exactly the same for those two different players, rather than capitalize on the fact that that dude just does it different. He's got his nails cut longer, or he has heavier attack. This guy is a little bit more gentle, and this drummer lifts his foot off the ground and stomps and puts the hammer and lays it against the head, as opposed to a guy that does the heel to toe technique thing. It's the same damn drum. It's the same mic. It's the same preset. It's totally different. And learn from that and wiggle around that and figure out how I can take this exact same drum set and have two different cats play it and have it sound different. That's more interesting to me than making everything sound like a brick wall metalcore album that sounds exactly the same all the time. It's going to get very boring. Like, how many different things can you possibly throw at people before they go, oh, this shit all sounds the same? Because it does, you know?
Yeah, it's all about being malleable, really, and reacting to everything that's around you.
Malleable.
Yeah.
You vocab word.
You've got to be that type of the type of person that knows three different ways to do X, Y, and Z, but open to the fact that there's probably a fourth and fifth way that you might discover today.
Sure.
And that might be because you have to, or it might be because you don't want to, but you have to. Like, I don't know. I've worked with people before where I'm like, okay, I totally know exactly how to make drums awesome. And then get somebody who comes to the door who just completely shatters the whole idea. You know, and I'm not sure how. Like, there could just be, like, maybe you just get a guy, he just hits a snare drum a certain way. You're like, what? That sounds amazing, and it's different than every other drummer I've ever recorded. How are you doing that? And
right.
It's just like, I'm just hitting the drum the way I hit drums. So, I've always absorbed all of that. I've never gone into it thinking I'm the know-it-all and I know exactly what I'm doing. Now, of course, there's a certain degree of that, especially after time and success, you start to become a little bit more confident. But I'm not so quick to be like, no, it has to be this way, because I know that doing that over a long period of time will create a monopoly, which, and when I say monopoly, I'm talking about a very static, you know, narrow path. It's something that can't become this because the rules. It can't become this because of that. That's against those rules. So I know that every once in a while I got to bend this way and bend that way, which sometimes forks into new little pathways of thinking and also problem solving.
Right.
And that's the more interesting way, or actually it's an interesting way to approach the craft, but it's also, I think, the right way. Mm-hmm. And I know we always talk about there's no right and wrong way. I think it's the better way, right? It's the best way.
Right.
And if Dave Grohl was in the studio and he's like, dude, I want my kick drum to be made out of a trash can. There's a reason why he's thinking that. And even if he doesn't know it, it's something. It's like mm-hmm. his gut or whatever. Something is telling him he has to make this kick drum a trash can. So
okay.
You bet your ass that I'm going to figure out how to capture the essence of a kick drum, but also the essence of a trash can. So that when somebody listens to this song, they're going to like, did they use a trash can on that kick drum? Because
right.
mm-hmm. that sounds like a kick drum trash can thing.
Yep.
And there's a reason why Dave Grohl wants to do that. And there's a reason why, obviously, there's a reason why I want to approach it from a, well, why would you do that? That makes no sense. And right. of course you should have a normal kick drum. You have to fight that, though, sometimes. You have to be willing to kind of go a little crazy every once in a while and go, you know what? Let's do it. Let's make a kick drum out of a trash can. Let's figure it out. I don't care if it takes 3 days. Let's...
Otherwise, that's what's important. Otherwise, you cranked out the same kick drum sound, like you said. I heard you say the word monopoly. I'm trying to think of a more fitting word for it, but I know what you mean. If you're going to become the guy who only does bleh, kick drums sound like that. Well, I want something to sound different. So now you, Joey, are the wrong guy for the job because I want mine to sound like a trash can.
Right?
That's ridiculous. Well, no. Now you can do everything from I can get your kick drum to sound as good as it did on Devil Wears Prada or Asking Alexandria or whatever. Or I actually have experience making it sound like a trash can, which you never – as crazy and ridiculous as that sounds, it's the diversification and the fact that the dude's willing to go off the map. I don't know if this is true or not. Maybe as a producer, maybe you ever heard this. I thought somebody told me that they took – For Downward Spiral, they took the drums to an upstairs apartment, put one microphone into a stove, and opened up the stove to do March of the Pigs.
And
the drums sound like shit, which is what makes them sound awesome for that song because it's so dirty and raw and dirty on your nail, you know? Why? Who in their right mind? If you walked into my studio as just this guy in Connersville, Indiana, who said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put a Shure 57 in a stove. You're going to be like, you're a nut, and I'm leaving, and I want my money back. But now it's looked at as, wow, that's genius. It's because you had to try it.
For sure. Let me just say two things about that. So
go ahead.
First thing I'm going to say is that a lot of people believe that I am a one-trick pony, and that is a popular belief on the internet. If you do research on me,
okay.
you'll see – that a lot of people are like, why does Joey Sturgis make every band sound the same? I'm going to tell you that the reason why it happens or even the reason why you think that happens is bands will literally come through the doors and say, we like the Amir record that you just did last month and we want ours to sound like that. And if that's what the paycheck requires,
yeah,
that's what I have to do because I'm at the end of the day, I'm a fucking waiter.
Yeah,
you're at the table and you're going to order exactly what food you want. You're going to eat it the way you want to. Right. And all I can do is help get it to you faster and help make sure that you had a great time doing it and all this. So I have to approach it that way. Now, speaking about the microphone and the stove, that is exactly what I'm talking about. And it all comes down to identity. That exact sound that they created is not, you can never make it again. You're never going to get those drums in that same building going in the same direction, bouncing off the walls, the way they're positioned and set up and going down the stairs and entering into the stove and bouncing around the stove and going into the microphone. Like that creates a unique sound, and that identity is so transcendent. Like you can play that sound to an audience and have the stage be completely black and everyone knows what's going on.
Right.
They know the identity of that sound. They know it means this song is coming on. This is They know the words to that song. And that's because those guys are clever in the way that they've constructed the production and everything down to the catchiness of the lyrics and the vocal patterns. Mm-hmm. But it all comes back down to that identity of that sound. And I've always tried to do that with my productions. I've always tried, even though sometimes I'm in a certain mold, I've tried to be like this. I want to have a sound somewhere in the song that identifies it. Mm-hmm. It gives it its own unique audio identity. And I think that's what's so brilliant about how Trent Reznor approaches production, is that he tries to make every single sound come from a place of ingenuity and uniqueness, which allows or basically prevents anyone else from ever copying what he's doing, because you just, right. you're never going to be able to put all those variables together ever again. Right. So.
Yeah. Give me the open stove door plugin.
Yeah.
No,
it doesn't exist.
This is going to sound weird. This is really going to sound hippy dippy. I honestly believe, and I'm not even sure if I'd be able to pick up on it, but I think if you set up the exact same scenario using the stove analogy, and you went into it with an attitude of, man, this is crazy. I don't know if this is going to work or not. As opposed to, I'm excited. This is awesome. This is exciting. We're forging new ground here. I think you'll hear that difference. I really yeah. honestly think that has something to do with the vibe in the room. That's what makes music magical.
Everything is about perception. Mm-hmm. It's all about the expectation and the perception of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can influence that by presenting your fucking weird idea
trash can
in the most right. confident way ever. Have you heard that song White Limo by Foo Fighters?
Love that song.
You can't understand what he's saying.
Nope.
And it's awesome.
Yep.
That's exactly what we're talking about. He's like, dude, I don't know why, but I want my voice to sound like shit, and I want it to sound like it's coming out of a old beat up car that's distorted
mm-hmm.
or some crap like that. And it works. And the reason why it works is A, the crazy idea is unique, and B, they presented that idea with complete confidence.
Mm-hmm.
They were like, this is exactly how this song is supposed to sound. This is what I dreamed in my head, and here it is in reality. Is it the biggest pop single of the century? No, but not everything needs to be the biggest pop single of the century.
And it probably came with an entire package in his head, because he is like, I mean, he's like the ultimate podcast guest. I would love to crack that dude's head open and read the thoughts that fall out. You know,
yeah.
I'd love to read what he has thrown away.
Yeah.
You know, but White Limo, have you ever seen the video for White Limo?
Yeah. And it's created in a unique way.
Lemmy is the limo driver.
Yeah.
That's the joke. Lemmy doesn't drive.
Yeah.
So the entire thing was probably the thought of it was tongue-in-cheek from the beginning.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, awesome. And yeah, can I understand? Can I sing along? No, I just scream at the white limo part, and I'm just playing air guitar on my steering wheel. I can't sing along because you're right. I don't know what the hell he's saying, but yeah. I get it. And that's what makes it all so important. And I like, I going back to what you said about, I want you to make this sound like something else. Here's the paycheck.
Okay.
Like, I talked to my tattoo guy, and you walk in and are you a tattoo guy?
I'm not, but I totally, I mean, I can talk about tattoos.
Flash is the stuff that's already on the walls. And you go through the big poster things, and you're like, "Oh, I want."
They don't want to do any of those.
No, and every shop has them hanging in there because it's the same reason why microbrews serve Bud Light. Somebody's gonna walk in here and want one. Yeah. So that tattoo artist doesn't want to do a Lucky 13 horseshoe, but three people asked for it that day. That's what I want. How much you charge? $80. You got it. Okay, fine. Yeah. I'm the waiter. I'm delivering it. You walk into a tattoo artist and say, "Hey, man, I have an idea. I'd like this. I want this. I want it here. And I know I don't want this. Other than that, it's yours. You create it. You're going to get the better tattoo because you're letting that person go, now I get to cook the chicken the way I think it's going to taste the best.
Yeah.
Now you're going to let Joey Sturgis mix the way he thinks he can make your band sound the best. If I go in there and say, make my band sound like Devil Wears Prada, you can do that. Matter of fact, honestly, am I not ripping myself off a little bit? Don't you already have those presets? Like, you have the Devil Wears Prada preset ready, right? Yeah, I mean, yeah. If you just go, okay, and you hit the big Devil Wears Prada button and charge what you charge and go, that was easy. I kind of, like you said, I was the waiter. I just delivered.
See, now that's where you start to get into the whole competitiveness and it's interesting because, you know, you can go to the store and you can pick four different kinds of milk, and some of the companies have the same label. They look very close to each other, and that's them going, we need more sales. We need those labels.
Right.
You know, and that's what it is. It's like you've got the, I don't want to name names, but let's say Band A comes in. It's like, man, Band X is killing it right now. We need to make more money. We need to ramp this thing up. We want our band to be more like Band X.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they come in, and of course, that's my job, is to say, well, when I worked with Band X, we did this, and this is why we did it. And they're like, oh, okay, yeah, we like that. Let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happens sometimes. And of course, I get blamed, but you know, I've been able to rise above that, I think, and show that I am more than just a one-trick pony. I'm sure that I am talented and creative, and I can just look at Joey Sturgis Tones, and I imagine some people probably think that I'm just like a brand or like a name on the end of the plugin or something. But like, mm-hmm. Every single idea, every single advertisement, every single marketing campaign has all been from my brain. I run the whole thing by myself. I answer the emails by myself. I do customer support by myself. I have a couple of guys that help me now. Like, I don't draw the freaking knobs because I'm not an artist. You know?
Sure.
I've got a guy that draws the knobs for me because
right.
Can't do that.
Right.
I've got now when I started, I had guys that helped me made videos. But then one day I was like, you know what? I'm tired of not being able to translate what's in my head to an actual YouTube video. Okay. So I went to Best Buy and bought a camera, read the manual, literally page from front to back,
mm-hmm.
learned how the camera worked, watched some tutorials, picked it up, started shooting and recording. Now I make my own videos.
Right on.
I do all my own editing. I do all my own sound editing on my videos. I make all the songs that you hear for the advertisements and trailers, and it's so much work, but to me it's not, it seems like a lot of work, but to me it's just living life. Like, I don't feel like I've ever worked a day in my life because I just get to be creative and do what I want to do. So I try to stay away from projects that feel like work. And that goes back to what I was saying earlier, which was like, you know, am I the right guy for this rock record? Well,
okay.
If it sounds like, you know, I'm going to be pulling teeth to convince the vocalist to make choruses that go like this, then why am I doing that? If that's the right move for the band and for me, then yeah, maybe I do need to go through that process of pulling teeth. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's a part of my progression as a producer and also a part of their progression as an artist. But not every time is that right. Sometimes that pulling teeth can be a more unnecessary experience and a more painful experience. And you have to have, like I said, that gut instinct of knowing like where you fit in. But some people don't have a choice. So I always go back to saying, like, when you start out, you have to keep in mind that I'm up here 10 years later, like thinking about things in a completely different way than I would have when I started.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start, you're hungry, you need to eat, you need money, you got to do projects. So you're going to work through situations where you can't be like, I'm not the right guy for this band. Well, maybe rent is due and you don't have a freaking choice.
Right.
You're going to learn from that, though. And I think you should definitely just keep an open mind and look for new opportunities. Don't look for the old, outdated piece of crap music industry way of thinking where, oh, I need to record label projects and the music industry is controlled by record labels, so I should do this. There's people out there who have 10 million whatevers. 10 million of anything is good, let me tell you.
Sure.
That you could be working with, and that would be just as good, if not better, because look at Apple Music. And I really sincerely believe in 5 years that Apple will have a record contract for content creators. If that happens, every person will have a platform to do everything they need to do. They'll be able to put out their own videos on YouTube because you can run YouTube by yourself. It's not very hard. You can build your own audience on Facebook. Facebook makes it pretty easy to advertise and build audiences. Then you can release your music on Apple Music. Apple Music is making it easier to distribute music now. Everyone has iTunes. So it's not very long before you're going to be funding yourself and just doing your own content. And I want everyone who wants to be a producer and get into the recording business behind the scenes, I want them all to realize that.
Mm-hmm. I think it would behoove the musicians to stop worrying about ordering t-shirts and start learning how to do this stuff on their own.
The other thing is there's a lot of trust placed in record labels, but there shouldn't be. And I don't want to talk too bad about record labels. I mean, I make a lot of money from record labels. So if you're a record label and you're watching this, don't hate me. I'm just being analytical and honest about the industry. And you can't always trust a record label that they're going to have the best. Now, of course, they're always going to try and have the best intentions for you, but they're not going to be capable of always doing the greatest job ever for every single band they ever sign.
Mm-hmm.
If that was true, why is music history the way it is?
Yeah.
Right? Why are there lawsuits and why isn't every band the biggest band ever? Okay. Sure. So sometimes you end up on a record label. You think we're doing it. We're killing it. We're on a record label. We're going to blow up now. Not always true. And if you don't have the numbers that some guy comes in every morning and checks and is like, nope, you're not part of the club now because your numbers aren't this high.
Right.
Guess what's going to happen to you? You're going to be screwed. So I'm always saying that if your goal is to work with record labels, you have the wrong goals. You should want to work with record labels. And I'm not saying not to do it. In fact, if the opportunity comes across your desk, please do it. But don't aim only for that. You should aim in so many other directions because there's so many more exciting things happening right now.
So that to me makes a lot of sense. That sounds like I'm going to start a band and I am going to write some songs. We're going to practice. We're going to get nice and tight. And then I'm going to go after our first show to be Madison Square Gardens.
No. And look at
it's not going to happen, dude.
Last Night. Have you heard of that band?
Say it again.
Our Last Night.
I'm sorry. I have not.
Okay. I'm going to look them up right now. This is a cool band. They were on a couple different labels. Then they started to get really big on YouTube because they started to cover songs, and some of those went pretty viral.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing that happened is that they started to make more money by doing all that other stuff, and they were still on this label, and then nothing was happening with it. So they literally got off their label and became a bigger band because of this YouTube thing. They've got 506,000 subscribers, 80 million views. The band's called Our Last Night. They now they shoot their own music videos. They record, mix, master, produce their own albums. They do their own distribution. They do their own merch, and they do their own tours. They do everything themselves, and they're completely self-sufficient. They're on, they actually have a tour right now, October 21st to December 12th, called the Younger Dreams Tour. It's USA, Russia, UK, Europe. Insane, dude. Like,
that's all unbelievable.
No label, like, just on YouTube. And I know for a fact, like, because I have inside information, I talk to industry professionals all the time.
Sure, I bet.
They are looking for YouTube people right now. Like, that's what record companies know, that this doomsday is coming.
Mm.
And they're like, we need to sign YouTube. We need to sign YouTube people. So that's happening now. In fact,
go deeper into that. You sign YouTube people.
The record companies want to go after the YouTubers and make them sign record deals because they're afraid that they're not going to have, they know that this is the next wave. This is always talking in the music industry, always talking about what's the next thing, right?
Sure.
What's going to happen next? Nobody could have predicted Nirvana. But somebody was sitting in an office going, all right, if I pump $100 million into this, we're going to get a billion back. Somebody knew that, and that's what happens. I don't know if that's the exact numbers, but just for
example. I get the point. Yeah.
So
I don't think they believed it. Dave, speaking of Grohl, he's going on record as sitting in the office, and they said, what's the goal? What do you want to do with this band? And Kurt said, I want to be the next biggest band in the world. And I think it was the South by Southwest speech where Dave was like, at that time, the week that he said that, Wilson Phillips, Hold On, was a number one song.
Yeah.
And he, Kurt said, I want to be the next biggest band in the world. I think even Chris and Dave were like, what? Like, there's no way. Look what they're listening to. And look what happened. So, yeah.
So, the record labels know that this whole YouTube thing, if you paid attention this year, Warped Tour had a Brian Starrs tent, right? Do you know who Brian Starrs is?
I don't.
Okay, let me.
I don't get out of the house much, Joey.
That's fine. Brian Starrs is he's a YouTuber that just sort of like is friends with a bunch of music people and he goes to events and he interviews them, but he's so much more than that. He's created a giant empire around the whole situation. There's merch now. And then he's got like, you know, he will like debut bands because his channel is so big so that he breaks bands. He actually broke my fiance's band, Conquer Divide.
Wow.
We did a deal with them. We said, you know, can we put our, we made a lyric video for one of the songs that I produced. And then we said, hey, can we put that video on your channel? And he said, yes. And then of course all the record industry people watch his channel.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they saw the band. And
he's a tastemaker.
Yeah. He's a tastemaker. He has 709,000 subscribers, 118 million views. Is huge. Just huge. Gosh, almost 250 million views. So record labels know that this is happening. So Brian Starrs actually had his own tent on Warped Tour. Like, it was an event. In fact, I challenge you to do some research, go back and look at Instagram photos of his tent, because what you'll see is a line of 500 kids just dying to meet Brian Starrs. And what does he do? He's on YouTube. He makes videos and he interviews bands. And he had a line of hundreds and hundreds of kids just dying to even just see him. That is making waves in the industry. I know the music industry people, record labels know that they need to start taking advantage of that. If they don't, they're going to miss out on a big wave of opportunity. So, you know, I'll mention some of my good buddies here because I like to give some shout outs. But Jared Dines, for example, Rob Scallon, Ryan Bruce, Jared Along,
mm-hmm.
Steve Terberry. Actually, Steve got signed. Steve Terberry.
Signed as a YouTuber.
Yeah, he's a YouTuber that has a record deal. Like, he got signed by a record label. 241,000 subscribers, 20 million views. Steve Terryberry. Now you also see on the other flip side, like I said, our last night, you know, No Label killing it. Also, Lindsey Stirling, the violinist that dances and stuff. Have you seen her?
Oh, I think I do know who that is.
Yeah, yeah.
Finally, so I know what the hell you're talking about.
Yeah, she's all over the news right now because she did $6 million last year revenue. So there you go.
I don't even understand where the revenue comes from.
Just advertising? I mean, as we go to talk all day about how that happens. First of all, you can make a lot of money on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
You're not supposed to. I'm a YouTube partner, so I can't really say what the numbers are. But there's sort of you can look it up. There's a formula. It's not exact because every single ad has a different amount of money attached to it. So there's no way you could be like, oh, well, every view equals 10 cents because some views get ads, other views get better ads, other views don't get any ads at all. And so, like, it's a big mismatch of crap.
Okay.
So some some channels are on a network, and the network actually pitches your channel to specific ads. So if I'm a music channel, maybe my network pitches me to Gibson, and Gibson pays more because now they're advertising to music people, and they know that.
They're getting a better bang for that buck.
Yeah, so that's how the whole YouTube advertising world works. On top of that, though, she's touring, so she's making money from touring. She's selling merch. She's making money from that. She's selling music. She has, like, I'm pretty sure she has gold records. I could be wrong, but she's definitely got, like, a gold single. She had a song with the singer. What's her name? Let me just look up her channel.
Take it.
She's doing songs with, like, celebrities and stuff, too.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Lizzie Hale, sorry. You know, from, what band is she in, damn it. I'm a fan of that band, too. Hailstorm.
Oh, okay. I've heard of Hailstorm.
Yeah, the singer of Hailstorm did a song with Lindsey Stirling.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at the song right now. 40 million views on the song. Lindsey Stirling has 7 million subscribers. Now, if I have an app that tells me estimated income from a video. It's going to be wrong, but it's a close shot in the dark.
Okay.
It tells me that this video alone probably earned $59,000. One video. You imagine the amount of content that goes on to YouTube, too. Now, not every video makes money, and not every video is going to be 40 million views.
Right.
But if you take that stage and you own it and you embrace that opportunity and you do something cool that people love, it's the most incredible time to be alive, because you can make it just like that. You can take that little file that's on your computer and drag and drop it onto YouTube and instantly become Lindsey Stirling, like, if you're the right person doing the right thing at the right time. So I think there's a whole new way of thinking on this whole music thing.
Isn't that interesting that there are still people making money in the music industry, and they're not bands and they're not record labels?
Yeah, exactly.
They're a lady with a violin who shot a cool video. Or
guarantee you that Lindsey Stirling doesn't want to edit vocals or mix songs.
Yeah, and it sounds like she might actually be able to afford to pay you to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Not so you, Joey, you, whoever's listening and wants to get into this kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah,
this is, I did not see the conversation going in this direction, but that's pretty cool just to see that there's
pretty eye-opening.
So much opportunity. Wow, that's cool, man. Well, what else you got? You want to talk about anything else? You know what? Yeah, I want to talk about something.
Okay.
I think if you Google you, the biggest thing that comes up the most often is the whole Asking Alexandria thing.
And sure.
How big it was and you know. How did that all come about?
That's a good question. And I got a good answer for you. So Ben Bruce was sitting in, I think it's Dubai. Ben Bruce is a little bit of a world traveler, so I might have the country wrong or whatever, but I think he was in Dubai. He was sitting there and was listening to all this American metalcore movement coming out of the Midwest. And obviously me being a part of that, you know, doing the Prada record and the Attack and all those bands, sort of early on Rise Records, Burden of a Day. He was paying attention to all that stuff happening, and he was listening to the records. And what he started to notice is he was opening the records and going, Joey Sturgis, opening the next one, Joey Sturgis, opening the next one, Joey Sturgis. He's thinking, wow, who's this Joey Sturgis guy? Cause I love this one, and this one. His name was on all three. So he went online and did some research and found my MySpace. Now, at the MySpace
keeps coming up. Isn't that funny?
I owe my career to Craig Erickson, is the owner of Rise Records, and MySpace. Those two things allowed me to do everything that I'm doing. So whoever created MySpace, thank you. And obviously, shout outs to Craig Erickson, because
There you go.
Love you like a bro. He has helped me so much in my life. So
you should probably tip your hat to Justin Timberlake now because he's in charge of MySpace.
Right. So, Jay, call me up when you want to party. I'll come hang out.
He might circle back around, dude.
I'm available.
You never know. Yeah.
So.
Okay, anyway.
So, yeah, anyway.
So he saw this one-trick pony that can obviously only do one thing in metalcore, and he was like, I better call this guy, right?
Yeah, basically. His manager hit me up. It was funny, too, because I had no idea. This was the first time I was really getting into, scratching my chin and going, who should I work with now? I really didn't have that option in the beginning, as you don't. The thing that was interesting about it to me is that they were from England. And I was like, I want to work with an English band. That's a cool accomplishment. You know, that's something that would be cool to do in my life.
Okay, sure.
So I was approaching it from that point of view, and I really didn't know what I was getting into. And I don't think they did either, but they came over to America and they lived in an RV that they had bought. I think they managed to raise like $80,000 or something like that, saved up a bunch of coins and whatnot, flew to America, bought an RV. I think it was an RV. Yeah. And found some random American kid to drive it. Like crazy stuff. I mean, they started out the most chaotic freaking way possible. I mean, they just literally hit up a random kid on MySpace and that was their driver. Like, it's insane. Like, anyway, they drove to wherever the hell I was. I don't know. I was in Connersville, but for them, that was like, where are we?
Right.
What are we doing? Lived in the driveway of the garage and just came out every day and we recorded this little EP. It was pretty much the same story as Devil Wears Prada. Like the EP, they got shopped by their management company and then they got a record deal from Sumerian Records. And then I kind of knew what I was doing. So I was like, all right, I'm going to win this band. Like they're going to be my band. Like I'm going to make them so happy. I'm going to make sure that they, you know, that we get along and that I understand their artistic vision, offer my creativity to them completely and openly and just do the whole thing, you know, like just, I'm going to be your dude. So I did that and it worked and they love me and I love them and we worked together ever since. I've done all their stuff. There was just the one time where they wanted me to mix the record during a certain month and I wasn't able to go back on my obligation. So David Bendith actually ended up mixing that one.
Okay.
That was From Death to Destiny. But now we're working on the new record right now and I'm doing everything. So,
so the one time you didn't do one thing for them was only because of just schedule.
Yeah. It was just a schedule problem.
Okay. All right.
And a really deep financial situation. I mean, I would have lost so much money if I would have done that. So I just can't do that. You know, I would lose my house. Like can't do it. They're like, okay. And obviously they're not going to pay for my house, you know? So, just had to go to Bendith for that.
So you went to your friend's garage, started tinkering around, figured out a sound, started doing work, asking for work, going after Devil Wears Prada. Joey Sturgis here, mixed by Joey, mastered by Joey, whatever. And some dude caught your name because your work spoke for you and you got the call from them.
Yeah. And I didn't ever approach it. I definitely did not ever approach it from like, well, if I'm going to do work, I should make money. I always approached it from like, well, I'm going to do work until it literally doesn't make any sense to not pay me.
Right.
Like, and to not pay me well. Like I worked so hard and I would only sleep like 4 to 6 hours a day and I would work on weekends and I would skip family holidays and I would skip funerals and like ruin relationships with people. And I'm not saying that you should ever copy this, but I'm just telling you what I did. Like I sacrificed my whole life and everyone that I knew to freaking pursue this. Once I knew that I was good at it and people wanted it out of me, and I could see a clear vision of like where this would take me years and years away. And when I knew that, I was like, all right, I'm dedicating myself to this art form right now. Luckily, it worked, and now I'm in a position to where I can pay attention to my family, and I can do these holidays, and I can take care of myself and my life, and my health. But yeah, when I started, I was just focused on the goal. And I think now more than ever, you might have to have that sort of sacrifice. You might have to make that sort of choice, because it's so saturated, and only the people. You know, I like to say there's a very entrepreneurial spirit, which is somebody wants to eat your lunch. And if you think about it that way, that'll give you a kick in the ass in the morning. It's like, wow, somebody's going to literally steal the food off of my plate today if I don't get up and make this song and mix this and master that and respond to this email and answer this text and make this phone call and pay this bill. And, you know, that should be motivation enough. Just
you
somebody.
You just titled this episode.
Awesome.
I'm going to call it.
So there you go. Hopefully that's some eye-opening stuff for your audience. And I think like now more than ever, you have to have an outside the box way of thinking, because the way everything worked in the 80s and the 90s and stuff, it's all gone. It's internet killed everything. All new ways of thinking, all new opportunities.
That's amazing. Wow, what a great conversation. The last thing I wanted to ask you about is I just spoke to Shane Carroll, lead scream vocalist of For All Eternity.
Mm-hmm.
And you mastered Metanoia for them.
Right.
How did that come about? Face Down, I imagine, approached you. Did For All Eternity request you? Yeah, the only reason I'm asking is because he was just a recent guest on the show, and when I got the when I got the Face Down information, I was like, I'm going to be talking to this band, I'm going to be talking to this bass player, I'm going to be talking to a dude named Joey Sturgis, and then when I got the thing from them, I was like, oh, look at that, I'm going to be talking to him in like a week. So I wanted to connect the two somehow.
Yeah. Well, there's an email that I put out every once in a while where people can hit me up if they want to hire me. And I kind of open it to everyone. It's only when I'm like super available and super bored, and I'll put it out and, you know.
Bored? When the hell are you bored?
Yeah, that's actually a good point. Luckily, I'm involved in so many things that it's pretty rare.
I was going to say, you don't twiddle your thumbs, dude. You have too much to do.
But sometimes I do like to work with smaller bands, and I don't mean that in a demeaning way. I mean it in a more simplified way. The thing that's so great about these independent artists is that there's not very much red tape.
Sure.
There's just not very many politics to deal with. You don't have to worry about, like, well, is the label going to approve this word being here? And can we have this kind of sound effect on the album? And like, you don't have to worry about any of that kind of stuff. You can just do whatever you want. So sometimes I like the freedom that comes along with working with smaller or independent artists. It just allows me to have some fun with what I do. So I think that's how that came about. They probably just emailed me and I was like, let's do it. You know, let's have some fun.
Very cool.
And if you ever... You know, if you're watching this and you're interested in what the email is, it's joeysturgisrecording@gmail.com.
There you go.
So hit me up if you need mixing or mastering, and we'll see what we can do.
Joey, I want you to send me an email. You dropped so many websites, so many email addresses.
Okay,
so many names and everything. Send me an email. I will make a big, fat, ridiculous chunk of show notes for people to just be able to click on a link. But send me everything that you want me to put in there. And I can't thank you enough for your time, man. I know you're a busy guy. And thanks for getting this all set up and talking to me, man. I really – this inspired me. It really
did. That's great, man. I hope to inspire people, and I hope to inspire other people to not just chase the audio industry but to chase their dreams. And I think that I'm a good example of how you can do that. And end up somewhere cool. So, and by the way, thanks for having me on the show, and I appreciate your time as well. So.
Oh, you're quite welcome. No problem, man. Somebody's going to eat your lunch.
That's right. Tomorrow. Better get up and do something.
That's right, man. Thanks, man. Take care.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Cut that part out. That sounded salty.
Yeah, you were okay.
I meant salty. You're... like the songbook.
All right, but I want you to keep all of that except for when you shit on it.
We love you. Take care. Bye-bye.